from the Pardes Institute of Jewish Studies, this is Pardes from Jerusalem. I'm Larry Kluger, a Pardes alum. This week, Bo. If you haven't done so already, please check out our website for electronic learning. That's lmad.pardes.org. It's packed with resources, including podcasts and other learning that you can download, so check it out. lmod.pardes.org. This week, Bo with Rabbi Leon Morris. Rabbi Leon Morris is the president of the Pardes Institute. And now, Rabbi Leon Morris.
Thank you, Larry. The very first mitzvah in the Torah directed to the Jewish people occurs in this week's parasha, Parashat Bo, just prior to the Exodus from Egypt. Vayomer Adonai el Moshe ve'el Aharon be'eretz Mitzrayim le'mor ha'chodesh hazeh lachem rosh chodashim rishon hu lachem l'chodshei hashana. The Eternal said to Moses and Aaron in the land of Egypt, this month shall mark for you the beginning of the months. It shall be the first of the months of the year for you. The mitzvah of establishing the calendar precedes every other mitzvah that becomes central to Jewish life. It is the defining mitzvah of a people who come to see God in time. Time, after all, reminds us that we are part of a larger universe in which our individual lives do not stand at the center. It tells us that the rhythm of our lives is tied to the rhythm of the world. Abraham Joshua Heschel writes about this beautifully in his beautiful book, The Sabbath, Its Meaning for Modern Man. Judaism is a religion of time aiming at the sanctification of time. Unlike the space-minded man to whom time is unvaried, iterative, homogeneous, to whom all hours are alike, quality-less, empty shells, the Bible senses the diversified character of time. As opposed to shrines or sacred mountains, Heschel explains that Judaism teaches us to be attached to holiness in time, to be attached to sacred events, to learn how to consecrate sanctuaries that emerge from the magnificent stream of the year. There is, I think, today in Jewish life, a widespread alienation from the Hebrew calendar. There is an urgent need for us to re-experience its power and meaning, to open ourselves to be uplifted and inspired by it, to feel renewed by it, to allow its days to recalibrate our lives and to enter fully into its rhythms. There's a wonderful new book on the Hebrew calendar by Abigail Pogrebin called My Jewish Year, 18 Holidays, One Wandering Jew. And she sets off on a spiritual journey to celebrate and mark and learn about every single holiday in the course of the Jewish year. She writes in the introduction, "It bothered me that I had never lived the entire Jewish calendar. I wanted to understand what we non-Orthodox Jews are missing, not just the facts and figures of Judaism, but their expression in real life. I aimed to climb the scaffolding of a more rigorous Jewish life without knowing the outcome." I recommend it as a beautiful memoir and guide to recapturing the power of the rhythms of the Jewish calendar. Calendars, of course, have been issues of tremendous importance in every culture. They are, in many ways, the defining feature of culture. And that's why battles over the calendar have historically been filled with such import. Whoever controls the calendar controls time. And whoever controls time controls almost everything. This explains why the division that existed for centuries between the Western and Eastern Christian calendars was such a significant division. As you might remember, what we call our civil calendar today is actually a calendar that was adopted by Pope Gregory XIII in 1582. It's the Gregorian calendar. And until then, the Christian world had followed the Julian calendar. Now, the reason for Gregory's reform was that the Julian calendar had assumed that the cycle of the earth around the sun, the time between the two vernal equinoxes, was 365 days and a quarter, when in fact it's 11 minutes shorter than that. So that minor discrepancy of 11 minutes meant that about every four, after about four centuries, there would be a difference of 3 days. And so at the time of Gregory's reform, the equinox, for instance, had shifted from March 21st to March 11th. So to compensate for this, the Gregorian calendar expanded the number of leap years to include all years divisible by four plus every century that's divisible by 400. For example, the year 1900 was not a leap year, but the year 2000 was. So the most fascinating piece of this change, this reform that Pope Gregory made in his papal order in 1582, was that everyone in the West had to give up 10 days. The date immediately went from March 11th to March 21st. This is fascinating, at least to me, on its own. But I'm bringing this up because such a correction, even though it made sense, was not accepted universally, at least not at once. There was a strong resistance for centuries from non-Catholic countries. For instance, England and colonial America didn't adopt the new calendar until 1755. Greece didn't adopt it until 1923. So changing a calendar is not easy and not a light decision, because the calendar is indicative of identity and affirms the authority of those who shaped it. But the calendar is also serious business, particularly to religious communities, because, as Heschel said, time itself is holy. In fact, for we Jews, holiness exists primarily in time. So first, a few basics. When one hears that the Jewish calendar is lunar, that's not exactly accurate. Our calendar, in fact, is both lunar and solar. The months are measured by the cycle of the moon, but the year itself is measured by the cycle of the sun. You see, it takes approximately 29 and a half days for the moon to revolve around the earth. Therefore, half the Hebrew months are 29 days and half are 30. But a year is measured by the cycle of the sun. The year is reflective of agricultural seasons of spring, summer, autumn, and winter. There are holidays like Pesach, which mark the beginning of the earliest harvest, the barley harvest, and Shavuot, which marks the first fruits, and Sukkot, which commemorates the final harvest of the year. In a lunar calendar alone, these festivals would, over time, occur at various parts of the year, the way that Ramadan has occurred in the spring as well as the summer and winter. But the Hebrew calendar, with its solar year to compensate for its lunar months, ensures that Pesach is in the spring, Sukkot is in the autumn. How does it do this? Not unlike Pope Gregory's reform. There's an additional month added to the calendar 7 times in every 19 years. And this compensates for the discrepancy between 354 lunar days and the need for 365 solar days. Interestingly, I learned several years ago in an article by Rabbi Yoel Ben Nun, the Yamim Noraim, the high holidays, subtly acknowledge both of these calendars. Rosh Hashanah, which occurs on the first day of the month of Tishrei, is day 355. That is the first day of the new lunar year. But Yom Kippur, 10 days later, is day 365. It's the last day of the solar year. So he suggests that if we come to think of the new year as a season rather than a day, then what we have is Rosh Hashanah marking the beginning of the lunar year and Yom Kippur marking the end of the solar year. And both days are ways of marking time, ending and beginning in a new year holiday season. Now, I may have captured the attention of those of you who are animated by math and science and a bit of history, but I fear that I've lost the philosophers and theologians among you. So beneath all of this technical background to the calendar lies some very profound ideas. First among them is the notion that the Hebrew calendar suggests to us a particular relationship between humanity and nature, between human initiative and God's power. In antiquity, and in the days of the ancient temple in Yerushalayim, in Jerusalem, before the calendar was fixed according to certain rules, the declaration of the new moon was dependent upon two witnesses coming to the Sanhedrin, the high Jewish court at the temple, and declaring that they saw the new moon. And even though this process had the potential for human error, the rabbis were adamant that it continued to be established in this way. There's even disagreement among the sages living after the temple's destruction, when witnesses can no longer testify to the Sanhedrin, as to whether it would be preferable to have human witnesses come and testify versus a fixed calculation. Human judgment, human intellect was placed above nature itself. What mattered was not the objective, indisputable fact of when the month began. The only thing that mattered was when we human beings acknowledged its beginning. I guess you could turn this into a kind of variation of the popularized philosophical question about a tree falling in a forest to say, if a new moon appears and no one acknowledges it, does a new month begin? The rabbis adamantly answer, no. Ramban, reading very closely the pasuk, the verse that we opened with, HaChodesh Hazeh Lachem Rosh Chodashim, Rishon Hu Lachem L'Chodshei HaShana, and the emphasis on Lachem, for you, this month for you, Ramban quotes the Midrash saying that this was for you, plural, for Moses and Aaron and comparable experts to determine when the month begins. I want to share with you a few short texts that demonstrate this. The first is from the Tanhuma, a collection of Midrashim edited in the 7th or 8th century. The Holy One, blessed be He, said, "From the time that I created the world, I bore the burden of calculating the months. From now on, it's given over to you. It is given over to you, but you are not given over to it." It once happened that Rabbi Chiya the Elder, that the moon rose on the day before Rosh Hashanah, and the cattle drivers traveled in its light for a distance of 3 miles. Rabbi Chiya saw it, took stones and earth, and threw them at the moon, saying, "It was our intention to declare you as new tomorrow, and you rise now." It was immediately swallowed up in its place, meaning the moon disappeared. Why so? Because it was given over to his control. In this fanciful tale, a leading rabbinic figure not only has authority over declaring the new moon, he also has, it seems, authority over the moon itself. The next text speaks to a situation where the testimony of witnesses seems to run counter to what is observable with the naked eye. This is a famous story from the Mishnah, Masechet Rosh Hashanah, chapter 2, Mishnah 9. There was another incident in which two witnesses came and said, "We saw the new moon in its time, but the next evening it was not visible." Nevertheless, Rabban Gamliel accepted their testimony. Rabbi Dosa ben Harkinas said, "They are false witnesses. How can witnesses testify that a woman gave birth, and the next day we see that she's still pregnant?" Rabbi Yoshua said to him, "I agree with you." Rabban Gamliel sent for Rabbi Yoshua and said, "I order you to appear before me with your staff and your money on the day that is Yom Kippur according to your calculation." Rabbi Akiva went and found Rabbi Yoshua in distress, and he said to him, "I can prove that whatever Rabban Gamliel did is valid because the verse in Vayikra, in Leviticus 24:4 says, 'Ela moadei Adonai asher tikru'u otam b'moadam.' These are the feasts of the eternal holy gatherings which you shall proclaim." That is, you proclaim them, whether they're at the correct times or not at their correct times. "These are the only feasts I have." In other words, if Rabban Gamliel said that the new moon, the new month, begins on a particular day, and that therefore affects even when, obviously, Yom Kippur would fall out, that such a rabbinic declaration means that the day actually will occur according to that declaration because of the pasuk, "Ele moadei Adonai asher tikru'u otam b'moadam." These are the feasts of the eternal, and you shall proclaim them. You have the authority to proclaim them. Our liturgy, the prayer book, reveals this as well and illustrates the difference between the festivals, which are dependent upon human beings to declare the months and establish the calendar, and Shabbat, which is entirely dependent on the natural cycle. On Shabbat, in the Amidah and in the Kiddush, we say, Baruch Ata Hashem Mekadesh HaShabbat. Blessed are you, Eternal, who sanctifies the Sabbath. It's all God's doing. But on Chagim, on festivals, we say, Baruch Ata Hashem Mekadesh Yisrael VaHazmanim. Blessed are you, Eternal, who sanctifies Israel and the festivals. Mentioning the sanctity of Israel before the sanctity of the festivals. The Talmud tells us that this is because Israel sanctifies the new moon, and it is on that basis that the festivals are determined. Human beings, human courts, human discernment is at the heart of our religious calendar. Shabbat remains paramount, our most sacred festival, and that's determined by God alone. But the rest of the calendar is ours. And in this balance between Shabbat and the festivals is the partnership that defines our relationship with God. We matter. Our minds matter. Our humanly shaped institutions and structures matter. But they are in balance with another recurring facet of life that lies beyond our control. More than this, however, Sforno, the early 16th century Italian commentator, explains that when the Torah writes, "This month shall mark for you," the word lachem is to be underscored. Sforno writes, "Mikan va'elech yihyu ha-chodashim shelachem, la'asot behem kirtson chem, aval bimei ha-she'ibud lo hayu yimeichem shelchem, aval hayu la'vodat acherim v'ritzonam." So Sforno is saying that from now on, these months will be your months to do with them as you please. In the days of your slavery, your days were not your own. Rather, they were for the service of others and were spent at their will. Therefore, this month is the first of all the months of the year. Beginning in the month of Nisan, you begin to live in freedom and choose what to do. It's not just that the months are determined by human discernment. That large role comes to reinforce the notion that our entire calendar stands as a reminder that we are no longer slaves. Each day on the calendar, suggests Sforno, is a day spent in freedom. Ramban, who I quoted earlier, mentions with regard to this verse that the months are not named in the Torah. The Babylonian names of the months that we're familiar with, Nisan, Iyar, Sivan, Tammuz, Av, Elul, etc., those names come later. The names of the months in the Torah itself are numbered, the first month, the second month. And Ramban says they're numbered so that each month is not really telling you where it is in the context of the year, but rather in the context of the anniversary of our freedom. V'zeh ta'am rishon hu lachem, she'eneno rishon bashana, aval hu rishon lachem, she'nikra lo l'zikaron gu'ulatenu. That the verse says the first month for you, it's not the first month of the year, says Ramban, but the first is called for you in remembrance of your redemption. There's another element. The word for month, hachodesh hazeh, employs the same root as the word for renewal, chidush. The moon is about marking time. We must learn to mark time, to not allow time to simply pass by. Renewing ourselves means paying close attention to what we do with time. A beloved teacher of mine writes about matzah, Mark Allen Wachnin, that matzah is a bread without time that says precisely that we must not fall into the tap of passing time. Matzah is a reminder of the power of life that exists in everything and that endlessly seeks to act, create, and to invent. The mitzvah of marking months is a kind of renewal that asks even more of us. It asks us to consider making ourselves new, that slavery is about the same thing day after day. Who you are is defined and fixed, and time just goes by. Liberation, redemption, implies an ability to grow and learn and change. Such change requires a way to mark the passage of time. What Mark Ellen Wachnin writes about Pesach could be applied to the calendar itself as, quote, an ensemble of processes that allow one to free oneself from the institutionalized forms of experience to invent new forms of life. A person's different actions must try to invent new forms of experience that are never assigned, to exit from banality. The person who hears the first commandment, who agrees to leave Egypt, who understands that there is a God, that he is a God of liberation, is a person of chidush, of novelty, writes Mark Ellen Wachnin. The Hebrew calendar not only speaks to the central place that human beings play in God's universe, and not only about the renewal that is inherent or is a potential in every month. It is also a reflection of where truth is to be found. And here we must note the centrality of the moon to our way of marking time. And this too I learned from Mark Ellen Wachnin, that while the sun represents clarity and assuredness, the moon is about mystery, about all that needs to be discovered. For other cultures like the Greeks, the sun was central, and those cultures shaped philosophies that suggested that truth could be found and understood and grasped. But our Jewish culture, as revealed by its dependence on the cycles of the moon, is a culture shaped in many ways by the softer, less certain, more ambiguous qualities of the moon. Our moonlit civilization called Judaism recognizes that the most profound truths can be perceived in different ways. Judaism affirms the notion that seeing is not believing, and that the deepest ideas we affirm cannot be seen by the clear light of the sun. Ours is a culture of the moon, a culture of certainty but questioning. There is truth, of course, with a capital T, but as Jonathan Sacks writes so beautifully, Rabbi Jonathan Sacks, in heaven there is truth, but here on earth, all we are able to perceive are truths. So this dichotomy suggests a distinction between the Jewish moonlit way of thinking and Greek sunlit way of thinking. While Greek thought is most concerned with the answer, Judaism is primarily concerned with the question. Greek thought affirms that truth comes through certain knowledge, where Judaism affirms the importance of dialectic, the search for clarification in a world of uncertainty, a world where truths remain elusive and where meanings emerge only through the shadows cast by the light of the moon. Freedom from Egyptian bondage makes possible the meaning found in the shadow in the cycles of the moon. The Hebrew calendar reminds us that paradoxically overcoming slavery is about more than leaving the darkness and entering into the light. It's also about the freedom which allows us to voluntarily leave the light and to embrace the shadow, the freedom which encourages us to explore the uncertain but ultimately meaningful world of struggle, searching, and questioning. Finally, the Sfat Emet, Rabbi Yehuda Aryeh Leib Alter, who lived in the late 19th century, writes, Israel calculates its months by the moon, and the other nations calculate their months by the sun. Other nations only exist in times which are good and filled with light when the sun is shining. They exist and disappear. History knows many examples of this. But Israel lives and exists even in times of darkness and fog. Even in times of darkness, they are appeased by the light of the moon. Beautiful. But the moon is not merely a description of our resilience, nor does it only symbolize a history of suffering which has been ours. Another Hasidic commentator suggests that Israel is called to be like the moon in relation to God. Just as the moon reflects the light of the sun, so too are we called upon to reflect the light of God in the world. This is perhaps the elevator pitch of what Jewish life is all about. And the calendar, in its symbolic language, conveys that message to us. HaChodesh hazeh lachem rosh chodashim rishon hu lachem l'chodshei hashana. The calendar conveys this message to us. Our calendar helps us break free of slavery, of being in the same place, of being stuck. Our calendar helps us find a place between the poles of human initiative and God's command. The kind of renewal inherent in the Jewish calendar might be deduced from the blessing recited in the synagogue every month on Shabbat Mivarchim, the Shabbat prior to Rosh Chodesh, when the new month is announced, in which we say, Yechadshenu HaKadosh Baruch Hu Aleinu V'al Kol Amo Beit Yisrael B'chol Makom Shehem L'tova V'livracha L'sasonu L'simcha L'ishua U'lenechama L'farnasa U'lechalkala L'chaim U'lshalom L'shmuot Tovot ולבשורות טובות, לרפואה שלמה ולגאולה קרובה ונאמר, אמן. That may God renew for us and for God's people, the house of Israel, wherever they are, goodness and blessing, gladness and joy, salvation and consolation, a livelihood and sustenance for life and peace, good tidings and good news, for a complete healing and for imminent redemption. HaChodesh hazeh lachem rosh chodashim rishon hu lachem l'chodshei hashana. May our connection to the Hebrew calendar bring us these blessings and more.
Thank you, Rabbi Morris. Thanks for tuning in, and we'll see you on the next episode of Pardes from Jerusalem.